Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Rebecca Clayfish and I are asking for 4 more years to serve as your governor and lieutenant governor to move Wisconsin forward.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker announcing that he is running for a 3rd term at an appearance in Rothschild as we begin an election year on Route 51 by welcoming 2 state senators to debate the issues. I'm Glenn Mobrig. At least 7 serious candidates are running as Democrats in an effort to unseat Governor Walker, and we'll talk about that with 25th District State Senator Janet Bewley, a Democrat from Ashland, who joins us by phone today, and also 24th District State Senator Patrick Teston, Republican from Stevens Point, who is here in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio. And there is a lot to talk about. Aid to rural school districts, the end of the mining moratorium in Wisconsin, and the debate over sulfide mining, the decision to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison, the Foxconn development, the reorganization of the University of Wisconsin campuses, the proposal to drug test welfare recipients, the legalization of hemp, access to health care, and the impact of the new federal tax bill on our state. And no, we probably won't get to all of those subjects. We do invite you, though, to weigh in with your opinion or your questions. You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the our webpage. That's wpr.org/route51. Again, that's wpr.org/route51. And I will read it live on the air. So, Senator Bewley and Senator Teston, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be on.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Let's begin with the gubernatorial race, the subject we'll be talking about most this year, I suppose. Pat Teston, this will actually be the 4th time that Scott Walker will face the voters. Why do you think he deserves another term?
Well, I think you have to look at the results. When Governor Walker first took office back in 2011, the state economy was in disarray. We had record high unemployment. Our state budget had billion-dollar deficits. And through tough decisions and oftentimes contentious decisions, those decisions have put us in a place where our unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in over 20 years. We have one of the highest labor participation rates in the country. Our taxes are down. We have more people working than ever before in the state of Wisconsin. And we continue to make investments in the future workforce of the state. So I think the governor has a very compelling case to make to the voters of the state of Wisconsin in 2018. And I certainly believe he deserves another 4 years.
Janet Bewley, Democrats have tried to beat Scott Walker 3 times already. Why do you think this year will be different?
Because as he's moving Wisconsin forward, he's chosen to leave very specific people behind. Very specific parts of the state are left in the 20th century. Certain populations of people are left, struggling for jobs that pay a living wage. Too many people are finding it difficult to access health care. And by God, we cannot forget the bad roads that we have in our state. He's picking winners and losers, and there are too many losers that need to have the state go in the direction that's going to include them and not exclude them.
Well, Janet Bewley, there are a number of people running as Democrats, and I'm going to list the most significant ones in alphabetical order. Tony Evers, Matt Flynn, Andy Gronick, Mike McCabe, Malin Mitchell, Kelda Royce, Paul Soglin, Kathleen Vineout, and Dana Walks. Out of that group, who do you like?
Well, you know, I'll let the voters decide that. What I want to point out about this group of voters, of candidates, is they all represent very different parts of the state, very specific populations. Some of them, of course, represent the entire state, but through a lens. And that indicates to me that there are so many sectors of our state that do understand that they are being left behind as the other part of Wisconsin goes forward. Tony Evers is able to point out how certain schools are left behind as others get to move forward. Kathleen Vineout is speaking about the rural population. Dana Walks is concerned about many issues of fairness and access to justice. All of these candidates are coming forward because they truly believe that there are populations being left behind. I think that certain ones are going to come to the surface. We're going to see out very soon. We're going to see the indications of how much money they've raised so far, just how strong of a campaign they're going to be able to conduct. But I think we've got very formidable candidates among this big field.
Well, former Congressman Dave Obie has endorsed Dana Walks. He's an assemblyman from Eau Claire. Obie says it's important to nominate someone from northern Wisconsin. You're from northern Wisconsin. Do you think that should be a factor?
Well, I think that no matter who is nominated, that person has to be willing to recognize the entire state. And having a candidate that comes from the North is certainly a good start. I wish that I could say that it doesn't matter where you live. But if you live in the southern part of the state, you are hearing the noise all about what's going on in southeastern Wisconsin. And the needs of the rest of the state are being drowned out. So if we can find a candidate who is from a southern part or maybe represents Madison or Milwaukee, as long as they can hear the voices of the entire state, I don't think it matters where they come from.
Why isn't Janet Buley running?
Janet Buley enjoys representing the people of the 25th Senate. This is a district that has a lot of diversity. I could spend the next 4 years still learning new things about this very large, very complicated, and rich district. We have a lot of needs, and I'm not done fighting for them.
All right. There also isn't a candidate yet for the Democrats against 7th Congressional District Republican Sean Duffy. Why isn't Janet Buley running for that seat?
Same reason. I love the job I have. I don't want to move on to another job until I finish the one that I have started. And I think that until I can see the needs of all of the people of my district at least being understood and attempted to be met by the state of Wisconsin, I'm going to stay where I am and continue the fight.
Pat Testin, of the Democrats who have declared so far, which of them do you think would cause Scott Walker the most trouble?
Well, I think Tony Evers, of those candidates you listed, I mean, he's won, I believe, 3 statewide races, so he kind of has that campaign infrastructure in place. I think one candidate who recently got in the race, Malin Mitchell, who ran in the recall race for lieutenant governor back in 2012, I think he's someone that could potentially break through. But I think that would be both of those candidates, are candidates that the governor would like to take on. If Malin Mitchell aligns himself with organized labor, that's a fight that the governor has won time and time again. And it's too early to say who's going to break through. I mean, I think right now there's 16 to 18 listed candidates that are running for governor on the Democratic ticket.
Does that mean that we could get a fringe candidate on the Democratic side, somebody who just squeaks by with maybe 12-15% of the vote?
It's possible. I mean, with that many candidates, now granted, I'm sure some will probably tail off because to get on the ballot, you have to go out and get, I believe, 2,000 to 4,000 signatures statewide. To have that many candidates running trying to get those signatures to get on the ballot, I mean, I'm sure some will tail off before then, but you're absolutely right. And with that many people in a race, you could potentially have a fringe candidate get through with a small percentage of the vote, but have enough to move on to the general election.
Well, the highest profile thing the governor did last year was the incentive package and the waiving of the environmental regulations to get Foxconn to build that big plant in the southern part of the state. Do you think, Pat Testin, that will be an asset or an albatross to the governor's reelection hopes?
I think it's a tremendous opportunity for the state of Wisconsin. When the Foxconn development was announced in late July, it kind of sucked up all the oxygen down to Madison. And for me, you know, obviously this was going to be a huge win for southeastern Wisconsin, but I wanted to know what it would be for what it would mean for central and western Wisconsin. So I started calling business leaders, members of the tech colleges, the UW system, construction companies to get their feedback, and they all said, this is a great deal for the state. We see opportunity to be part of the supply chain. And for me to support this legislation, the Foxconn bill, there had to be 3 components: trust, balance, and accountability. And I think we got there through the changes in the legislature, some of the environmental issues, the initial wetland mitigation. For every acre of wetlands that Foxconn is going to develop and fill in, Under the original bill, they had to reclaim 1.2. That got changed to 1.2 to 2 acres. So for every acre that they fill in, they have to create 2 new acres of wetland. There was concerns with the tax credits that the tax credits are going to go for low-wage jobs. Well, again, we fixed that. They don't receive any tax credits for salaries below $30,000 or over $100,000. There was accountability measures where Chairman Gao is on the hook. If this thing doesn't go through, then there's clawbacks to the state. But more importantly, we invest in Foxconn so long as they invest in the state. And it's the opportunity of a $10 billion investment in the state of Wisconsin. They do not get a blank check of $3 billion to build. They have to hit particular benchmarks. And so if they can hit the 10,000 jobs, I mean, that alone is $700 million worth of new revenue and income taxes in the state of Wisconsin. And the supply chain alone, initially it was estimated that 150 companies would be part of the supply chain. Well, we contacted WEDC yesterday. So far, on the Foxconn portal, over 500 companies from around the state in every Senate district in the state of Wisconsin are companies who are eager to be part of the supply chain. So I think this is going to have a ripple effect throughout the entire state of Wisconsin.
Janet Bewley, your impressions of the Foxconn proposal and development?
Well, as you know, as it was proposed and as I reached out to the people of the part of the state that I represent and beyond, it became apparently clear that people realized from the get-go that it was giving away money that that needed to go to parts of the state that are already underserved. So we are looking to a future where the not only the oxygen is going to be sucked out, but the revenue is going to be sucked out. Parts of the state have been underserved before Foxconn. So if $3 billion is going to go overseas to help this company and the intended benefits are going to only benefit a certain part of the state, we need that revenue to get us into the 21st century just as a starting point. Now, I know that there are attempts to document that somehow this is going to benefit the entire state. I cannot imagine what business in Florence County is going to benefit, what business in Iron County, in Barron County is going to benefit by Foxconn. We know that some indications are that of the 72 counties in the state, 23 will see some sort of effect that will have a measurable positive impact on the economy. This is at a time when we still have not had the investment in transportation in the northern part of the state, that we are falling behind. Our schools are still not where they need to be. We are giving money away when we need it here in Wisconsin, and we needed it before. And again, we are turning our backs on the people who have requested, who have demonstrated a need for this revenue, and we are instead ignoring them and leaving them behind.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Republican Senator Pat Testin and Democratic Senator Janet Bewley about everything involved with state politics. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Janet Bewley just mentioned education and funding for education. I caught up with Governor Walker Tuesday in Athens, where he was pushing a bill sponsored by Representative John Nygren of Marinette to bring more money to rural schools. It would raise the amount of sparsity aid going to small districts from $300 to $400, and it would allow some districts to raise property taxes without a referendum. I asked him about the reaction of Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling, who called his plan an election year gimmick. Here's the exchange. Let's listen to it.
This is just one more tool to help local school districts, particularly smaller rural districts that have been revenue challenged in the past, have the resources they need.
Governor, your critics are charging that the additional money for schools is because you're running for a third term. Is that true? And how would you distinguish your position on money for schools from that of Superintendent Tony Evers and the Democrats who are running with him to take your position?
Well, Dr. Evers, to his credit, actually praised what we did yesterday because he was being intellectually honest, unlike the others. I proposed this a year ago. So if they're saying it's an election year ploy, the only ploy being made is those who are cynics opposing it now. We didn't say that last year. We actually proposed in the budget. It was taken out. We're putting it back in again. Again, credit to Dr. Evers for being at least intellectually honest enough to admit and acknowledge that that what we proposed in terms of overall per pupil increases is exactly what the Department of Public Instruction asked for. What we proposed for additional sparsity aid in the budget was actually greater than what Dr. Evers and the Department of Public Instruction asked for. And so the only people who are being political about it are the people who are objecting to it now when we did it last year.
And that 2017-2019 state budget also provides a $200 per student funding increase for every student in the state and another $204 increase next year. Janet Bewley, your reaction to the governor praising state school superintendent Tony Evers and questioning the motives of Democrats who think the increases for rural education are an election year ploy.
Well, there's a lot to that question. First of all, the schools and the people who represent them are always going to be grateful for any increase that they get. So an increase is being proposed by the governor, and therefore you say thank you. When it comes to how much and when it's being proposed, it's too little and it's too late. Let's make sure that we understand two things. He did put in a budget proposal an increase in sparsity aid, and his own party took it out. It did not occur because Republicans did not want the sparsity aid in the budget, and it did not get there. So now he's asking for it again. However, when it comes to low-revenue schools, he vetoed that. So I don't believe that he needs to take credit for wanting to help the low-revenue schools when he specifically vetoed it in the budget.
Pat Teston?
Well, the criticism from the first day that the governor introduced his budget was that this was a Christmas tree budget, that this is a political gimmick. It's a re-election campaign budget. But the governor has been pretty clear. I mean, he has traveled the state. He's been in most of our districts time and time again to talk to school districts, both large and small. And even when I ran for this office in 2016, I heard that we needed to invest more in education. And so in this budget, we did exactly that. $637 million going back into the classroom to train up our future workforce of this state, a record investment. The fact that we're back at two-thirds funding from the state to our K-12 education system. And granted, we have the bill out there to increase sparsity aid because, again, the governor's heard and a number of us have lobbied him that this is important. We need this. Too many of our smaller rural school districts they've made the right decisions, the tough decisions, and have budgeted correctly. But because of that, their hands have been tied around behind their back. And so we see this as another avenue to help our smaller school districts get the resources that they need. So that way, no school district, large or small in the state of Wisconsin, lags behind another one.
Well, I had a chance to talk to the superintendent of the Athens District, Tim Mackey, and he said, Janet Bewley, as you suggested, the extra $100 per student would help him address some serious needs. But he also called that additional aid a tweak of the existing system and said we need an entirely new way of funding schools in Wisconsin, essentially a new school funding formula. I'd like to get the two of your reactions to that. Let's start with Janet Bewley.
Well, I would say exactly. We do, but the other thing that we need to do is address the elephant in the classroom, which is voucher schools, and the fact that a program that was initially meant to address some very specific needs in Milwaukee is now statewide, that the per pupil investment of public dollars into a voucher school student is higher than a public school student, and that we are continuing to see money specifically meant for public education moving over at a higher rate to fund private education. And that is fundamentally wrong. So you take that plus the tweaks that haven't been enough. I would agree with that superintendent from Athens and many superintendents from across the state that say we need to rewrite the entire thing. And Tony Evers came forward with an excellent starting point when he proposed his fair funding for Wisconsin.
Pat Teston, there's too much money for voucher schools.
I would disagree. Full disclosure, my wife works for the Catholic school system in Stevens Point, the Bocelli School District, where she serves as the director of development there. And I support the voucher system. I believe in competition within the educational system. And in actuality, you know, I heard this a lot from critics of the voucher school system, that there's no accountability. Well, in fact, any curriculum that a voucher school has to be approved by DPI. And the numbers that Senator Buehler mentioned just simply don't add up, because in actuality, a voucher school student, it costs about $7,000 to about $8,000 to educate that child. Meanwhile, in our public schools, it's around $12,000, $12,000 to $13,000. So in reality, it's actually less to educate a student in a private school system. But more importantly, it's about giving parents choices. Not every child learns the same way, and we can't have a cookie-cutter approach to education. And the parents should be able to decide what educational system works best for their child. And going back to the root of the question as far as the school funding formula, there is a task force that's been commissioned to take a look at that, because I think we do need a new formula, because the one that we have right now is rather archaic. And if we can streamline the process and make it a little bit better for our school districts across the state, I think that's only going to be to the betterment and a win for the state.
We're talking politics with 25th District State Senator Janet Buehler, Democrat from Ashland, and 24th District State Senator Patrick Teston, a Republican from Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on our website, wpr.org/route51. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Lincoln Hills, the closure of the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison, and the end of the mining moratorium in Wisconsin. But first, here's Caleb Santy and Andrew Christensen with a Wisconsin take on a song by Johnny Cash.
Rio, Chilton, Weston, Elkhorn, Seymour, Denmark, Mishicot, Conda, Jefferson, Brilliant, Wisconsin, Rapids, Lincoln, New Holstein, Plymouth, Olsen, Kewanee, Wanakee, Winnicani, Gale, Hatcher, Triple O, Belmont, Wyoega, Fremont, Hillsborough, into Horicon, Chilton, Burlington, Stoughton, Lake Holcomb, Glarus, Delvian, Darren, Edgar, Cashton, Darlington, Westby, Monroe, Judah, Wisconsin Dells, Bondewell, Wisconsin Heights, Mauston, Granton, Benton, Tigerton, Milton, Clayton, Ashland.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere. Across the deserts, bare man, I breathe the mountain air, man. The trouble I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like the Widener Center for the Performing Arts and Paisans play a huge role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
We live in a political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times when men commit crimes and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down, wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground.
Bob Dylan taking us into the next segment of Route 51 as we talk politics with 25th District State Senator Janet Buehler, Democrat from Ashland, and 24th District State Senator Pat Teston, a Republican from Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742 if you would like to join the conversation. I want to move on to another controversial topic, the new law that ends the so-called mining moratorium, or the Prove It First law, which required a mine operator to be able to identify a similar mine that had operated and closed for 10 years without pollution. The law, which was recently signed by the governor, will pave the way for non-ferrous or sulfide mining for minerals like gold, silver, or copper or zinc. Let's listen to a couple of clips. We're going to hear Raj Shukla. He's the executive director of the River Alliance of Wisconsin. He worries about the law's environmental impact. And also Republican Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst, who wrote the new law and says Wisconsin has valuable mineral deposits that should be mined.
We have one of the largest greenstone belts in the world. Some geologists rank it as one of the top five in the world. The Greenstone Belt is an area that has lots of non-ferrous minerals, gold, silver, copper, zinc, those type of minerals. We have them here in abundance here in northern Wisconsin. That Greenstone Belt runs from Ladysmith over to Michigan If you follow Highway 8 here in the far north, you will find where that greenstone belt is, and it could be a multi-billion dollar industry.
Sulfide mining, non-ferrous mining, acid mining, it's a uniquely risky type of mining. This isn't iron mining. This isn't frac sand mining. This is a type of mining that involves a process whereby ore is brought up, and when that ore is exposed to air and water, it can create sulfuric acid, which leaches into water sources and can harm people, can harm local businesses. That process involves the use of really noxious chemicals like cyanide, which again, when it enters into a water system, that's hard to get out. It's a uniquely risky process.
That's Raj Shukla, the executive director of the River Alliance of Wisconsin, and also Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst. Janet Bewley, that Greenstone Belt runs right through parts of your district. What do you think of the new law and the possibility of gold, silver, copper, and zinc mines in the 25th Senate District?
Well, you know, I reflect the attitudes of the people that live there, and they're scared, they're frightened. Taking away prove it first, meaning you don't have to prove it first, you have to go after them after something bad happens. It is a terrifying concept. And as you do that, you weaken the ability of our own state to monitor, to have the staff that they need to protect the land and water. You weaken the abilities of local governments to be involved in the process. It takes away the voice. It takes away the security of the people who live in these areas. And that's just another part of leaving people behind.
Well, there's something like 62 pounds of copper in every Prius battery. We need copper, gold, and zinc. Why not get it from northern Wisconsin, Janet Bewley?
Well, you may. And we had a law in place that said, go right ahead. Just prove it first. Just prove that you will not harm. Find a mine that is similar in size. And they will always point to Ladysmith and say, Ladysmith was a small mine, a very small mine that was in operation for a very short period of time. It is inappropriate to say that it worked there. Not only that, it may have worked there, but you still don't have to prove that you're going to be as careful, so said, as Ladysmith. You could mine. You know, the fact that there was what was called a moratorium did not mean that no mining was permitted. You just had to go through a process to prove that you would not harm the environment or people before you did. And now you don't have to do that.
Pat Teston, you represent Stevens Point. The mayor of that community, Mike Wiesa, signed a letter with Mayor Bob Mielke of Wausau and Zach Frewink of Wisconsin Rapids, pleading that the new law not be passed. Wiesa was concerned about a mineral deposit near a beautiful scenic area, the Eau Claire Dells, and he said if there was an accident or a chemical spill, it would not only ruin the Dells, but it would affect the water quality of the Wisconsin River in Wausau and Stevens Point. Why did you support the bill?
Well, I supported the bill for a couple of different reasons. One is that I see this as another opportunity to introduce potentially a new industry that's been a foundation of our state's history, and that's mining in the northern part of the state. Now, I'm the vice chair of the committee where the bill went to, and I had the opportunity to be at the public hearing up in Ladysmith late last year, and we had the chance to tour the old mine, Lac de Flambeau mine, and we were there with a number of individuals, and even there with George Meyer, the former DNR secretary and now the head of the Wildlife Federation here in the state. And we had a chance to sit down and talk, and it was really his testimony that really shed a lot of light onto this whole topic. And we heard testimony on both sides, for and against. But George, one of his reasons why he supported this particular law or didn't register opposed to it was that when he was DNR secretary, when the old law was going through, the mining moratorium law was going through, the Wisconsin DNR actually opposed it. And the reason was is because it set the bar too high, that essentially we would shut out mining here in the state of Wisconsin, because no two mines are the same. Because under the old law, you're comparing a Wisconsin mine to maybe mines up in the Arctic Circle or mines down in Arizona. No two mines are the same. You're comparing apples to oranges. And so along with that, and he also had several suggestions and amendments that would make the bill better. And so we took those in consideration and actually incorporated those into the legislation, making sure that the best practices are being used, making sure that the best technology is being used. And the final amendment that got this over the hurdle to get enough votes for it was that the bill does not go into effect until 6 months after it's been signed into law. So that way, local municipalities can put in zoning ordinances if they so choose to. So that way, any final approval will have local control. Those were some of the many reasons why I supported it. And it's important to note that the legislation that was signed into law did not change any environmental protections or standards. In fact, we actually added protections. We created a new permit process for the bulk sampling. That's kind of the in-between process of exploration to mine. So the bulk sampling, they have to go through a permanent process to make sure that's done safely. And when we look to our neighbors to the west of us, Governor Dayton, who I think we could all agree is probably a fairly liberal individual.
It's Minnesota.
In Minnesota, just 2 months ago, approved a sulfide mine in the Polynet project. So I do believe mining can be done safely. Minnesota's been doing it. Michigan's been doing it safely. And I see no reason why Wisconsin can't do it safely as well.
We're going to backtrack a little bit and get back to the school funding formula. We've got a phone call from Wayne in Marshfield. Wayne, you're on Route 51.
Good morning. I have a couple ideas as far as a new funding formula. I've suggested this to Bob Koch. The part on transportation, that if the state covered transportation in all schools, and that would start giving a level playing field for funding beyond that. Secondly, a student in a poor area does not have the same needs as a student in one of the wealthier suburbs. And I know this would get tricky, but if all students were tagged either as maximum need, moderate need, and minimal need, and the formula would be based, if a district has three-fourths of their students needing maximum need, that means breakfast and counseling and other amenities that help in the education process, that district would get more money, not just a flat amount per student. In a school in the suburbs might have three-quarters of their students need minimal need because they have high-speed internet at home, they have vacations, travel, all these things that enrich a student's life.
Wayne, we got it. Let me get a reaction from our guests. Janet Bewley, let's start with you. What do you think of the idea of tailoring need to school districts based upon concerns with poverty or relative affluence?
Well, I think that the caller raises a very interesting point, that children that come from homes that are disadvantaged or challenged in some way are need to have resources available to them in order to get an education. That there's, I mean, from food to begin with. We do have some standards kind of in place, not necessarily standards, but measurements. You know, the number of students who are eligible for free and reduced lunches. That's a percentage that is used in our state for many funding opportunities and also throughout the country. But even at that level, we can have those formulas, but the school needs to be a part of a larger community that is also being given what it needs to be healthy and strong. And if your basic fundamental services, such as roads and transportation, and as the caller says, access to the internet, are not being met in the entire district, having a funding formula that addresses this for the children puts an enormous burden on the schools. And I know that we want teachers to do everything, and they do everything they can. We need to fund our schools fairly. We need to address the problems of generational poverty, and we need to make sure our communities are strong across all measurements, in districts, communication accessibility, roads, the very basics have got to be met. And I do thank the caller for the suggestion about transportation.
Pat Teston, what would you like to see in a school funding formula?
Well, I think what Wayne had some great points there. And I think it is an interesting concept Because I do think the money should follow the child, because at the end of the day, education is about the children, giving them the best tools and resources they need to be successful. So when they leave the high school, and whether they go on to a four-year or two-year technical college or directly into the workforce, they're going to be successful. And they won't have to worry about, will I find a good job? Will I be able to raise a family, buy a home? So I think there's some merit to it. And so if Wayne has reached out to Representative Culp, Representative Culp is a personal friend of mine. I'm going to sit down with him when I get down to Madison this afternoon, and we'll chat about it.
Let's get into another big topic that affects north central Wisconsin, the decision to close the state's youth prison, the Copper Lake School for Girls and Lincoln Hills School for Boys in Irma. Lincoln Hills has been the focus of a federal investigation and at least two lawsuits. There have been several violent outbreaks among the students there, including one attack that knocked a teacher unconscious. Last week, Governor Walker announced that Lincoln Hills would be turned into a medium-security adult prison, and the young inmates there would be transferred to five smaller regional institutions at a cost of $80 million. The workers there would either get jobs at the new adult prison or at one of the new smaller regional facilities. I had a chance to talk to former youth counselor and current union representative Doug Curtis, and I asked him how the workers were reacting to the governor's plan, and he said it was mixed.
Some of them are relieved because they won't have to deal with the amount of violence and danger on the job. Some were hired on with the intention of helping these kids. That's why they came there. That's why they took the job. And without kids there, well, the reason they took the job is gone. They're not going to be in as much danger. The adult minimum security that they're talking about would be substantially less dangerous. But they're also going to be pumped with a ton more overtime. They're not going to get rid of the overtime until they hire people. And they've shown that they don't want to hire people.
It's Doug Curtis, a union rep, saying the workers would be safer in an adult correction facility, but he doubts the governor and the Republican legislature will hire enough guards and other staff members to cut the overtime and improve working conditions. Pat Teston, the words he used to me are that you Republicans like doing things on the cheap. Those are his words.
Well, we always want to make sure that we're using taxpayer dollars wisely and most effectively. But obviously, in corrections, There is a huge shortage of workers, and so that does need to be addressed. And I have heard from constituents who either work themselves within the corrections facilities or know family members that do who have shared that same sentiment that work conditions need to be better. Now, in regards to Lincoln Hills, I think this is an opportunity to tackle two issues at once. We obviously need more space for adult facilities. And we also need to make sure that those juveniles are getting the trauma-informed care and best practices to get them rehabilitated to be members of society once again. So the governor's proposal is actually a proposal that was kind of taken up by bipartisan legislators in the Assembly, State Representative Scott Krug and Representative Evan Goyke out of Milwaukee, who both—
A Democrat
from Milwaukee, who initially floated a bill a couple weeks ago that took a lot of these issues into account, and then the governor took it one step further because in Representative Krug and Goyke's proposal, they set no timeline. They wanted to study the issue to see if it's feasible to do so, and then the governor took it one step further that he wants us in the next state budget, that the Lincoln Hills will become a adult facility, and then we'll go to five regional base facilities for juveniles, which I think that's the way to go. When it comes to corrections, we have to think outside the box. It's not enough these days to simply lock up individuals and throw away the key. We can't afford to have anyone on the sidelines, and so we need to make sure that we can get them to become proactive members of society once again and through rehabilitation practices and get them on the path to prosperity.
This was supported by a Democrat, Evan Goyke, from the Milwaukee area, but it was also called a hollow campaign gimmick by Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling. Janet Bewley, what do you think of the governor's proposal?
Evan Goyke proposed a bill in this current session that could be enacted now. The governor kicked the can into the next budget and made a campaign promise. Two very different things. The governor has done nothing about Lincoln Hills, and now he says, I will do it when I get reelected. These are kids in some of the worst conditions you can imagine. We have heard incident after incident for years years, and now he's saying, I'll do it when you reelect me. I think that is insincere, and if he really wanted to do something, he would take Evan Gwaike's bill and he would see to it that it was passed now.
Well, with all due respect, Senator, I mean, Representative Gwaike's bill didn't put in a timetable. It simply just wanted to study the issue to take a look down the road. So there was no definitive time when Lincoln Hills would be closed. And in part, the governor did act, and he took it one step further. He took the ideas that Representative Gwaike had and Representative Krug and decided this is an issue. We need to act on it, and so we're going to tackle this in next state budget. So I think we should not only be thanking Representative Gwaike for pushing this issue, but then for Governor Walker to listen and decide that this is a pressing issue that needs to be handled in the next state budget.
Well, Pat, Doug Curtis and a teacher who was brutally assaulted at Lincoln Hills, Pandora Lobox, were both on this radio show, and they said that they blamed the governor's Act 10 for the unsafe, violent working conditions there. They said when the Republicans and Governor Walker passed Act 10, it eliminated the power of their union, which kept them from having any input into working conditions and controlling management's push for mandatory overtime. Your reaction to that, was Act 10 a factor in what's been going on at Lincoln Hills?
You know, I'm not sure if it is directly related to that particular incident. I know that teacher, I mean, she was viciously attacked. I mean, I saw the news story, and I mean, her face was a lot of damage done there, which was terrible.
But why take union rights and power away from people who work in a youth prison?
Well, it goes back to that initial argument that should the public sector have that ability? And, you know, that was kind of the whole jettison of Act 10 is that, you know, for years, things kind of went too far, that unions had too much say and too control in the process, and we need to make sure that the taxpayer dollars were being used to a more accountable measure. Now, again, part of the issue within the corrections department is that there's a worker shortage, just like in many sectors all across the state. We need more workers, and we need to get people into these fields.
Janet Bewley, what do you make of the position of union leader Doug Curtis and Pandora Lobox, the teacher at Lincoln Hills, that the Act 10 union reforms were partly to blame or mostly to blame, they say, for the unsafe conditions at Lincoln Hills?
Well, I think we're suffering from shortages in the workforce all across the public sector because of Act 10. When people are denied a voice in a way that has been accepted and the governor unilaterally removes it in a pretty dramatic and cruel way, you can remember when the bomb was dropped. The intention was to deny rights and, you know, save money, cut wages, cut benefits. It was very clear. The governor didn't mince words about what he wanted to accomplish, and I guess he accomplished what he wanted. And now he has a workforce. He has an occupation sector that is very difficult to fill because of the working conditions, because of the lack of voice, because of the treatment of public employees as if they are unworthy of certain rights to a certain voice in their working conditions. But I will go back to the fact that the governor is the governor. There are many things he could do about Lincoln Hills that he could do right now. He could have done it in the budget that we are living with right now. He could have done it in the budget before, but he didn't. And he isn't doing it now. If he wants to help people, if he wants to improve the working conditions, do something now.
Janet, we've got to move on. We're way behind time. We are talking politics with State Senator Janet Bewley, Democrat from Ashland, and State Senator Pat Teston, Republican from Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break. Here are the Temptations.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Grab on, brother. Grab on. Revolution, got control of sound, so shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to soon. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
So, round and around we go. Where the world's headed, nobody knows.
Support for WPR comes from Water Street Deli, with six flavors of hummus and pita chips made in Wisconsin. Available at Woodman's in Onalaska and Altoona. More is on Facebook at Water Street Deli. Support also comes from Garden Visions, a conference for northern climate gardeners of all levels, January 19th and 20th at NTC in Wausau, sponsored by North Central Wisconsin Master Gardeners. More at gardenvisions.info.
Oh, Wisconsin. Oh, Wisconsin. Oh, Wisconsin.
A group from Madison, Loxley, taking us into our final segment of Route 51 as we talk politics with Janet Buley, a Democrat from Ashland, state senator, and also State Senator Pat Teston, a Republican from Stevens Point. I want to, in the few minutes we have left, I want to touch on one issue that just came up in an article in BuzzFeed. And Janet, this is going to be directed at you. Northern Wisconsin has quite a few Native American tribes, and one in particular near your hometown, the Bad River Tribe, has been rocked by an incident in which a teenager, 14-year-old Jason Pirro, was shot and killed by a sheriff's deputy. An expose that appeared just the day before yesterday in BuzzFeed detailed a severe level of mistrust between the Red Cliff tribal members and law enforcement. The article also alleged that Indian women had been raped and assaulted in the Ashland County Jail. How serious is this problem, and what are the solutions, as the state senator representing that area?
Well, it's certainly extremely serious to the Bad River community and to the community of Ashland County, and I believe that people are taking it seriously. The incidents that were reported in BuzzFeed did take place, and there was another tragic outcome. The officer involved in those allegations did commit suicide, which all of this are terrible things for a community to face. The death of Jason Pirro is another difficult blow to the community. Very complex, many issues involved, including going all the way back to tribal rights, the treaties that have been in place, the moving of Native people to reservations, and the generational effects of the poverty that has lingered in northern Wisconsin for a long time now. We have to address this across the board with all of the different elements that are involved. And I believe that by shining a light on it, we are all able to look at and find those areas of where we are responsible and work immediately to effect change.
Pat Teston, what can be done on a statewide level in the legislature to improve the relationship between the tribes and the people in the communities that border their reservations?
Well, I think we just have to do a much better job to reach out to them, myself included. I have a number of Ho-Chunk within my Senate district, and we as elected leaders, we just need to go do a much better job to reach out to them to learn about their issues and more importantly, their culture, because it's so easy for us to kind of live in our own bubble that we oftentimes don't take into account the perspective of someone else's culture or their experience. And so we have to walk in someone else's shoes for a day. And that's, you know, what I've tried to do through my time in office with my On the Job series, working at different employers for an entire day, just because you never know how a law is going to impact a certain individual unless you walk in their shoes for a day and actually do their job. And so we just need to do a better job of outreach.
Janet Buley, you've got the last word here.
We need to identify those things that we have in common. The Native peoples of northern Wisconsin are Wisconsinites. They are people that are with us. They are our neighbors. They are a vibrant, strong community. We have neglected to identify the most appropriate ways to have us be a united community, and we must do better with that. The level of unemployment, the life expectancy, these are realities on the reservation that we must join with them to address.
We want to thank both of you for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And thanks to our guests, 25th District State Senator Janet Buley, Democrat from Ashland, and 24th District State Senator Pat Teston, Republican from Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Caleb Sandy and Andrew Christensen, Bob Dylan, The Temptations, Loxley, and the University of Wisconsin Symphonic Band. Next week on Route 51, we look at the reorganization of the University of Wisconsin campuses with UW-Stevens Point Chancellor Bernie Patterson, UW-Marathon County and UW-Marshfield-Wood County Dean Keith Montgomery, and Professor Kelly Wills, who teaches at UW-Marshfield-Wood County. If you missed part of this program, it will be rebroadcast in its entirety Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau, and it can be downloaded at wpr.org/route51. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.